From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Let's go out into space, Joel. Not deep space.
Oh, good.
Just near Earth orbit. Let's talk about meteor scatter. That's what I mean. Let's talk about rocks flying into the atmosphere and the fact, which I'm willing to bet much of our audience perhaps doesn't know, the fact that hams can actually bounce signals off of these things over considerable distances.
Indeed. And in fact, the same Mike Villard that we talked about last time, the physicist from Stanford, W6QYT, wrote the first QST article that I could find describing meteor scatter to amateurs in 1953. And this is something that had been observed academically going back to the 30s, but it hadn't been brought to amateurs' attention until the 50s. And I guess probably because even though some of the early observations were on 20 meters, it really became popular with and works better at VHF in the upper HF and VHF range.
Yes.
Partly because, of course, on 20 meters, if you have a weak meteor scatter signal and you have ionospheric propagation also going on, you probably won't even notice the meteor scatter signal because it'll be much weaker.
That's right.
So if you have good propagation, you don't need it. And VHF, much of the time, does not share in that kind of propagation. So it's much more likely that you can hear signals from meteor trails. And I guess it's not actually the rocks themselves.
That's right. That's a point I wanted to make, yeah. Yeah.
But it's actually the ionized trails, the meteor trails that you actually can see in the sky sometimes. Typically, they're billions of particles entering the atmosphere every day. Even a small portion of them provide a large number. So you aren't talking about reflecting from a single meteor trail necessarily. You're talking about a cluster of them, perhaps,
yes,
that are in the right place to provide or to support communication between places.
And since these particles are coming in daily, and by the way, this figure may astonish you or astonish some people in the audience, the Earth sweeps up between 500 and 300 metric tons of space debris every day, every 24 hours, believe it or not. And much of this is the size of grains of sand or even smaller.
I see them on my car.
Well, sweeping the dust off every morning. Some people think when they consider meteor scatter that, I have to wait for a meteor shower, you know, like the Leonids or the Geminids. No, it's available to you every day.
Absolutely right. The trails are typically in the E-layer, so you get propagation that's much like, and the distance is much like you have for sporadic E. So it's that kind of a height kind of thing. And it generally works best in the 30 to 50 megahertz range, but it can support transmission up into the VHF region as well.
Yes.
So the height of the E layer is about 70 miles. So to get the maximum distance through this kind of propagation, you need fairly low angle radiation. But fortunately, on VHF, that's easy to get because the antennas are high enough that you get low angle radiation. And that can give you a maximum range of about 1,400 miles.
Yes, absolutely. You're rustling your paper.
Sorry about that.
You have trivia. you have lines and lines of meteor scatter trivia.
I do. So the actual bursts of meteor ionized trails can be short, or the propagation bursts can be short. I mean, it doesn't mean there aren't lots of other propagation paths around, but for a particular path, the duration of the burst can be short, and as the frequency goes up, the duration of the burst actually gets shorter. So they can actually range from fractions of a second to multiple seconds. Now, what makes it work very well is if you have enough meteor trails going on in the same region that they start overlapping, and then you can actually get into a realm in which the propagation is supported long enough to support single sideband. But most people use CW or the new digital
JT
modes to provide transmission that gets through in very short interval kinds of things.
I have made a few, not many, single sideband meteor scatter contacts. Once, in fact, on 6 meters, I worked a gentleman, his call sign escapes me, but he was in Cincinnati, worked him from here in Connecticut. And we actually enjoyed, and admittedly, this was during a meteor shower, but we enjoyed a conversation that lasted, I would say, probably a couple of minutes.
Wow. That's
something like that. It was phenomenal. And I was only running 100 watts to a dipole antenna. I wasn't using a beam up on a 100-foot tower or something like that.
Well, and again, with good propagation through the E-layer, you don't need a real high antenna to get the low angles that supports this kind of communication. If you think about it, it doesn't take much to be up a couple of wavelengths on VHF,
yes.
Whereas on HF, that takes hundreds of foot towers. But on VHF, perhaps it's more important to clear the trees and the apartment buildings on VHF than it would be on HF. But if you have a clear shot to the atmosphere or towards the horizon, it can be a relatively short tower holding up your antenna, or even just a corner of your roof or whatever.
Corner of your roof, your attic, you know, whatever could do it, yeah.
And the fact that this happened during a meteor shower is not surprising, because there you had the higher density of trails.
Yes.
And more likely that you'll have overlapping coverage between trails that will support communication for some period of time. But as you say, it's always there, and it can be taken advantage of, even if they won't last that long. But that means you can't send a CQ on sideband and get very far, because somebody will get half a syllable here and half a syllable there, maybe.
Yes.
You won't know who you are.
In fact, you'll sometimes during the meteor showers, you'll hear that. You'll hear the... And then I said, and then you just get a couple of syllables here or there, and you can tell, oh, that's meteor scatter.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's take a break, and we'll hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
All right.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back. Joel, you mentioned software, and that is indeed, you know, my conversation about single sideband notwithstanding. That is indeed where most of the meteor scatter activity is happening, typically with Dr. Joe Taylor's WSJT software and the various modes that are in there. The most popular used to be FSK441, which would send the signal over and over and over, a lot of repetition, of course, digital signal processing and so on. You're exchanging just call signs, signal reports, that kind of thing. A lot like JT65 on the HF bands.
Right.
Very similar to that. Just recently, and if Dr. Taylor's listening, I want to apologize in advance for getting this wrong, but there is a new mode as part of his suite that has even greater promise for meteor scatter, and I believe it is called MSK441. Or no, that's not right. MSK-144, I believe. Wow. And supposedly, and I haven't had a chance to play with this myself, but supposedly it works even better and has promise of expanding meteor scatter activity even more.
Well, that's interesting. And I guess the key is that redundancy or an ability to somehow combine data over multiple transmissions is very important in this kind of environment where you have kind of a intermittent path, if you will.
Yes.
It shows up in fits and starts. You can't really predict when it will be. So having software that can deal with that environment makes a big difference. I was going to mention something else that may be of interest. There's kind of a related propagation mode that has been in the use by the military and others since the 60s. And it's a similar scatter kind of thing that typically uses frequencies in the 800 to 1200 megahertz. So we cover a couple of ham bands there too. and there's no reason hams can't do this, and it occurs via water vapor in the troposphere, which is about 10 miles high. So this, being lower in altitude, supports shorter distance communication, but it can be very reliable for distances up to about 200 miles. Now, because the density of the water vapor is not as high and it doesn't reflect as well as the ionized trails, requires high power and high gain antennas. But it's still something that, like meteor scatter, it's there all the time, and it doesn't have the fits and starts associated with meteor trails.
It's very consistent, in other words.
It's consistent, and if you have enough power to make it work, it'll work for long periods of time. This was very popular in the military. It was kind of got superseded by satellite communication, which, of course, requires, especially for low Earth orbit satellites, require very much smaller and antennas and lower power and more easily transportable systems. But recently, the tropopropagation is kind of come back because it's more secure than satellites.
Yes.
And it's not doesn't require any external facility. So while satellites can be jammed or even brought down in a conflict, there's no way that somebody can take away your water vapor in the troposphere.
Yes.
So I think it's coming back in for some strategic communications. And it's something that hams have also used to a certain extent, probably not as much as meteor scatter, but it just, I thought it was worth mentioning just because it's similar in many
yes.
ways.
How much power are we talking about for hams?
I really don't know. But I mean, the military systems I've seen had very large antennas for these frequencies and big structures, and, you know, they were still transportable systems, so that, you know, probably could be done with the same kinds of equipment that perhaps would be used for moon bounce, that sort of thing. That kind of power level and antenna, I would think, would work. I haven't really done the numbers, so I can't say. I just thought it worth mentioning for what it's worth.
Now, we're talking about, you mentioned the frequencies a moment ago, but are we talking microwave here primarily?
Yeah, 800 to 1200 megahertz is the typical frequency range used by the military. Now, I would guess if it works there, it could work a little less well at 432 and so forth. But, you know, we do have a couple bands at 900 and 1200
yes,
megahertz. So PAMs could do this if they put their minds to it.
Oh, yeah. Now, is this in any way similar to, or am I totally off base here, the, what was it called in the military, White Alice? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I've heard the name, and I've run it, you know, but boy, that goes back a long way, and I don't know the details of that.
Gigantic feed horns I remember seeing in Alaska in a documentary.
Oh, yeah.
So this was microwave, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And we're using some form of scatter propagation for, as you say, secure military communications.
Yep. Well, it could very well be the same thing.
So the idea being, really, whether it's the troposphere, whether it's meteors, that you're using this scattering phenomenon where either the water vapor in the troposphere or the ionized trails behind the meteors coming in at hypersonic velocities are scattering
yes.
radio signals.
Absolutely right. And the point is that there are a lot of ways. We think of VHF, especially those of us that work FM, for example, think of VHF as line of sight. And the point is there are a lot of ways to get beyond line of sight. So VHF can have a lot of interesting technical challenges that people can take on and make signals travel further than they might think they were possible.
And don't necessarily require an enormous investment in equipment, especially if, in my case, playing around with meteor scatter on 6 meters, which is where I tend to do it. Again, I've got a, you know, your typical DC to daylight type transceiver that happens to have 6 meters. I have a dipole up for 6 meters. It's 100 watts. And I have my Dr. Joe Taylor WSJT software suite and the sound interface. And that's all I need. And I'm working meteor scatter on a almost a daily basis.
Yep. Well, that's fairly typical, and so you don't have to do much, and your point is well taken. It doesn't take a big investment if you want to try it. And here again, you know, another thing to keep in mind is people with moon bounce have noticed, which is another way of extending your VHF range.
Certainly.
It's quite possible to have the station on one end do the heavy lifting. So if you have a really powerful transmitter at the other end and a really good
yes.
antenna and a good reception capability at the other end, perhaps with your 100 watts and a small Yagi, you can get enough signal up to the moon that person can get your signals out and can send a strong enough signal towards the moon that you can hear it with your station. So a lot of it depends on what the other end is doing.
Well, we had an article in QST a few months ago about a gentleman who was operating during the National Parks on the Air event, and he decided he wanted to operate moon bounce from a national park in Arkansas. And he took, I believe, an 11 or 12 element 70-centimeter Yagi antenna. He bolted it to the side of a barbecue grill in his national park there. Over on the picnic table, he had his laptop computer, he had the sound interface and so on, and he had an amplifier to kick the output of his 70-centimeter transceiver up to about 150 watts. And he pointed this thing toward the moon, and of course, as you've just said, the big moonbound stations elsewhere in the world were doing the heavy lifting, but he made a number of contacts that way.
It's always good to get somebody to do your lifting for you.
That's the secret of QRP.
Yeah.
That's right.
Sort of the Tom Sawyer painting the fence trick.
Exactly. I haven't heard it put that way before, but that's exactly it.
So all these things are worth trying, and it can be a lot of fun, and I urge people to get out there and give it a shot.
Absolutely. Joel, let's take a moment for a question. How about that?
Okay, sounds like a plan.
We have a question then from Ron, WD8SBB, and he asks, I've been looking around at CW signal issues and their cures, and I'm confused. Well, that makes two of us. I was especially surprised by a 1984 QST article that read, try this versatile CW shaper. And he says, how can an outboard device correct for keying issues inside a rig? Could you explain the issues of CW signal impairments, such as clicks and chirps, how they occur, and their cures? That's a good question.
It is a good question, and it's something that perhaps doesn't come up as often as it should if you listen on the air. There's quite a few of those. And while clicks and chirps might sound like they're similar in some respects, at least the words are similar, they are very different phenomena and need to be discussed differently. Chirps are perhaps the easiest to talk about, and especially since those are not usually the problem with recent gear. But they can happen as well. A chirp, sometimes it sounds more like a whoop. is an indication that the transmitter frequency is changing during the time that the key is down. Now, this is not too surprising because, in a way, what's happening is when the key is up, the transmitter is not putting out any signal at all. When the key is down, it's drawing a lot of current and generating this signal that's going out over the air. Now, if the circuitry in the transmitter is such that by drawing additional current, results in lower voltages in some parts of the circuitry or whatever, it can cause frequency shift. I mean, sometimes that's how you try to make frequencies change. But it was really a frequent problem in vacuum tube gear particularly, which is much more sensitive to this than modern solid state stuff. But there's really kind of a related issue, which is drift itself, which typically happens over time. So a chirp is a frequency change that happens while the key is down, while as drift is a frequency that shift that occurs over a number of dots and dashes. Perhaps you find yourself retuning the radio because the station is moving up or down the band. These are really related, and they both are kind of a similar phenomenon. And while it was more common in the vacuum tube day, I've actually experienced this with solid-state gear. I used to operate CW Mobile coming up to headquarters on my 60-mile jaunt, and I got a report on 40 meters that I was having a chirp. I was kind of surprised. I pulled up to W1AW and got Joe Karsha, the station manager, to help me out, and sure enough, I had a well-defined chirp every time I pushed down the key. You know, this was with the engine running so that the battery voltage was solid, and it took me a while to come to grips with it. But what I found was I made a few measurements of the DC power, and it turned out that the fuses that were supplied by the radio manufacturer, and there was one in each of the positive and negative leads, actually had voltage drop across them, or had enough resistance so that there was significant voltage drop when I went from, perhaps 1 or 2 amps when the receiver's on to 20 amps when the key's down and I'm transmitting. The increase in voltage drop resulted in a shift in frequency during the time of a key closure.
I remember you telling me about this.
Yeah. I was really quite surprised because who thinks of a fuse as being a problem? But it turned out it was the fuse itself. Joe fortunately had some bus fuses there that I put them in place of the ones that came with the radio, and the problem was solved. That was the end of that chirp. But there can be other kinds of things. I've had problems with extension cords on radios.
Yes.
I remember this goes back to the tube days, but it could equally well happen with a modern rig, and this is more of a long term than a chirp problem. But I needed to extend a power cord on my old Collins 32V1, which is a heavy duty power hog from the 50s. And I just found an extension cord and put it in. And sure enough, over the course of a transmission, extension cord got hotter, the resistance went up, and I was moving up and down the band. So it was an easy fix, but if you hadn't noticed it...
You it would drive you crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, during straight key night, just a month ago,
yeah,
I was using a homebrew single tube transmitter.
Oh, wow.
Because I wanted to be clever.
Yeah.
Right. But I had a heck of a chirp because I didn't have sufficient current in the power supply to supply this thing. I was using a different power supply. So despite every adjustment that I could make, I was still getting a whoop, 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 whoop. But of course, people thought, oh, great, he's operating some old rig, and yeah, isn't that charming, right?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Antique Wireless Association. They have some pretty good signals when they get out their 1929 transmitters. I mean, some of those things are pretty chirpy. But, you know, one good thing is you can always say, oh, that must be Steve over there.
Yeah.
I worked him already. I won't wait around to see who it is.
But now clicks are a completely different
phenomenon.
Absolutely,
phenomena. Yeah. Clicks are generally designed into the radio. And
after a fashion, yes.
Yes. Not intentionally, necessarily, but they are the result of the shape of the transmitted waveform. And basically the rule is the sharper the rise and fall times, which sometimes we think if we look at a pulse, oh, that's a nice square waveform. Well, the sharper that leading edge is, the wider the signal. The extreme example is a pulse with an infinitesimal width that's used for numerical analysis of circuitry, sometimes called an impulse. Very hard to make one of these because it also has an infinite amplitude to be an ideal impulse. But if you could make one, it would have an infinite bandwidth, which is, you know, sounds a lot like the old spark transmitters, actually.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, which is kind of similar. But so what happens is that the real signals have a finite rise time and fall time. And if it's quite sharp, they will have a wide bandwidth. And you can actually look at this. If you look at any product review recently of a transceiver, it will probably show you an oscilloscope plot of the waveform itself. And you can see the ones with very sharp edges. And then it will show you the bandwidth of the keying signal. And what you'll find is that the really sharp pulses, which look very clean and crisp, put out signals that are not clean and crisp.
No.
So the way to do it is to kind of shape the pulse so that it has a appropriately slow enough rise time. And some transceivers have an adjustment on this, so you want to make sure it's not set to be too sharp. But modern transceivers with digital signal processing that generate the signals digitally can actually shape the waveform in such a way that they produce minimum bandwidth or sort of ideal amount of bandwidth. If you go too far in that direction, what you end up with is a mushy signal that kind of runs, you know, if it's very slow rise time, you're done with the dot and it hasn't gotten to the top yet and it's coming down while you're doing the next one. So they kind of run the dits together if you're not careful.
Yes.
So it's a function of how fast you're going also. But there is an ideal waveform for any keying speed that will produce optimum bandwidth. There's one that's fairly becoming more common, and that's a raised cosine, which is a cosine waveform raised to a higher power. Radios with that kind of a generated waveform are not likely to be able to be modified by something outside the radio. That's built into the software that's generating the signal. But earlier radios using on-off keying that is generated directly by closing the key can have their waveforms modified by an RC network that actually changes the rise time of the current as the key is closed, depending on the keying circuitry. I mean, some are less able to be affected that way than others. So a delay in the rise time results in a softer, less clicky signal with a narrower bandwidth. And as I said earlier, you can go too far, get mushy, but it depends on how fast you're transmitting. So those are the two main things, clicks and chirps.
Clicks and chirps.
Yeah.
And how would I know how a chirp manifests itself on the air. How does a click manifest itself on the air?
Well, it sounds a little different. It sounds a little clicky.
Well, okay.
It's a very sharp transition. And that's if you're listening to the signal. But what you really notice is if you're listening to the signal half a channel away, you're trying to work somebody who's nearby, what you hear is you hear the clicks of that signal. Not in a nice tone, but you actually hear the clicks. And sometimes it sounds like a tone, but the actual transmitted signal is wider, so it spills over into the next channel. Sort of like splatter,
right,
on single sideband is a similar kind of effect. And sometimes you can directly relate it to the transmitted signal. If you're looking at it on a spectrum analyzer, a pan adapter, You watch some signals are quite wide compared to others. I've noticed them a lot on the VHF bands where often there's a lot of space around signals so you can see what's going on. You say, oh, my God, that must be so-and-so again. He's back on 2 meters now. This can be partly due, as we discussed in an earlier broadcast, to the nonlinearity of a, particularly for a sideband splatter, of these brick amplifiers that people use on VHF. But other amplifiers can be nonlinear, too. And again, you can look at the plots or the ratings of intermodulation distortion on transmit and the typically odd-numbered products, third, fifth, seventh, and ninth, and those extend out quite a ways from the transmitted signal. Usually the third is within the same channel. It can distort the signal you're listening to, but the other ones occur on the next channel and the next channel and can cause interference to other operators.
Thank you, Joel. That's a thorough answer.
Well, my pleasure, and I'm happy to be able to do it.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for The Doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.